Oh, I'm so glad the other two couldn't make it today. I'm Sean Hayes, and I am the host of Smartless. It's a show where we used to have two other hosts.
Balls on this guy? Can you believe the balls on this guy? I'm
Sean
Hayes.
Hello? Hello?
When they fucking plug my mic in, I'm going to light this kid up. Sean, I was told that
you guys couldn't make it.
That's weird, because I was just saying to my friend what a great job you're doing on the intro.
Oh.
So where does that leave us now? Just kind of like a enjoy the show?
Yeah, enjoy the show.
Smart.
Sean, Jason said to me the other night, he goes, I was FaceTiming him from his apartment. He goes, have you got it? Have you got, like as if it was like a, have you gotten into my crackers? And I go into his cupboard and I open up and I had taken a photo of his fridge and all how bare it was. And I sent it to him and Kimmel in Thoreau. And then I said, yeah, let's take a look at these crackers. They are the most unappetizing looking crackers you've ever seen.
Why? Because they're not edged in cheese or
they're not edged
stuffed.
In anything. It's cardboard with seeds. And then he says, I just come back from work and he goes, you eat after work? And I go, yeah, it's called dinner. You know, a lot of people do it. They've been doing it for a minute. And I was having salad with grilled chicken. He's like, what are you doing? Because that just doesn't compute for him because he just...
Wait, Jason, when's the last time you had like a burger or pizza or anything just horrible?
I had a burger about 3 weeks ago and it was incredible. You guys should check into it. It's
3 weeks ago.
Ground beef and they
3 weeks ago. Remembers the date. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Remembers the whole thing. Go ahead.
Well, it was on the calendar. It was on his calendar.
The bun was soft, but with a crispy little edge to it.
Sure.
I went ahead and had a little ketchup, lettuce, tomato, cheese.
Oh, good for you. Jason's death row meal, they'd be like, well, what do you want? Most people, you know, you'd be like, I want a thing and a chicken and a, you know, pasta with a huge thing and a sundae. And Jason's like, if I could have half a slice of a whole wheat pita, that'd be nice.
And a half hour on the treadmill. Is it available?
Uh-huh. Yeah, before he passes, before they wire him up to the chair.
Listen, I've told you a million times, there's a 600-pound man in here waiting to get out. I have to stay on the mouse wheel. Otherwise, it's not going to end well.
He's got me on this lemon water now too, which has nothing in it but lemon
and water.
Guys, speaking of 600 pounds, we have a guy today who has 600 pounds of talent.
Oh, 600 pounds of talent. Here we go.
What a description.
Isn't that a good segue?
It's the name of his autobiography.
Huge fan of this guy. I love that you have no idea who it is. I'm super excited that he's on the show. He's so nice to be here. I've been a fan of his and watching him for many, many, many years. I've never done a deep dive on this fella, and doing so for today, I had no idea we had so much in common. This is what we have in common.
Okay.
Uh-oh. I'm from Chicago. He spent quite a while in Chicago, specifically at Second City.
Not really in common, but go ahead.
Yeah, no. Specifically at Second City, which I also attended classes. He's Irish Catholic, youngest child of a massive litter. I'm also the youngest of a large Irish Catholic family. He is a big love of Lord of the Rings franchise, and I think you guys know how I feel about all of that.
Yeah, very.
Yeah, a million times. We both grew up playing Dungeons & Dragons. We both have a connection to The Daily Show. What's so funny?
Oh no.
Oh, no.
What's so funny?
The Dungeons & Dragons is just so you guys both just crushed a lot of ass growing up. That's covered.
Sean, dude, how excited do you get when you hear the sound? Pew, pew, pew.
I just soiled myself, I think. I get so excited.
Okay.
He's currently in first place in the million-year late-night talk show race. My best friend in the whole world, Stephen Colbert.
Hang on.
What?
Steven.
What?
Oh, I love the pan down, too. Tilt down.
Tilt down.
There you go. That's professional. That's how you get number one.
Yeah.
With that kind of technical expertise.
Wow.
You're not going to get that from Kimmel or Fallon.
Listener, he's in a very erudite, like library, home den.
It's kind of exactly how. By the way, another thing we have in common, Steven.
What is that?
Lord of the Rings.
Book, John, I
Lord
think?
Of the Rings.
What's that?
I love it. I can't
that
get enough of it.
One volume red book of Westmarch edition of the Lord of the Rings.
Wow.
That's the Lord of the Rings. All of this behind me on this shelf is Tolkien commentary or the unfinished tales like, The Fall of Gondolin or The Children of Húrin. Over here is more Lord of the Rings commentary. That's Smeagol. That's Gollum right here. What's this? It's Sting.
Wait, is that from the movie?
Actual hero sword.
He's holding up a sword.
Peter Jackson gave. This is one of the fucking swords that was used in the movies.
That's
look at
crazy.
That thing.
Lord. How did you get
okay?
that?
Okay, I don't care if you don't like Tolkien or the movies. You gotta like that.
You must have children that. All over the world.
How do you stop babies getting laid? Just, how do yeah. you stop getting laid? How are you just, not getting laid right now?
I fight him off
well,
with
that's
this.
Another one.
And Duril, which was given to me by Viggo
another
Mortensen.
Sword.
Fucking Viggo himself gave this to me dressed up as Aragorn.
No way.
And it was the greatest sex I ever had.
Wow. You and Viggo slept
wait
together?
A minute.
Is that
100%?
We're making news, guys.
100%, as I remember
did
it.
Did you buy those or were they given to you?
They were given to me. This is actually one of the stings from The Lord of the Rings.
That's incredible.
Wow.
And I had to actually pry these both away from my kids because when my boys were young, they would fight each other with it. I'm like, I could pay for your college with this. Give me that.
Listen, Stephen, it's great to have you here on the show, man.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. I am such a big fan. And just right off the bat, Stephen, is there some kind of like a mental adjustment you have to make in your brain to go from host to guest? Like, is your instinct to take over an interview when you're the subject?
Absolutely not. I'm fascinating and I am fascinated with me. I do almost every interview I do, I'm listening to the person going, I could answer this better than you.
Sure.
I could
sure.
answer.
Sure.
I've read your bio. I did the pre.
Yeah.
I know exactly how to fucking kill with this answer.
Right.
And you are shanking this. The urge to like just say, go, let's switch.
Yeah.
I'm happy to do
that. Do you
that.
Like
yeah.
that? Do you like when a guest comes on and they kind of freestyles and goes off script basically? Do you like that or do you like sticking to it?
As long as they've got a story, that's all I care about. But the only thing you don't want is for someone to come on and they say, just ask them about their first day on set.
Right.
Just ask them about first day on set. And then you say, you're a young actor. You're there with all these like huge stars. What was your first day on set like? And they go, it was great.
And that's it. Yeah. Oh,
full stop.
And then you go like, fuck me. They like, they don't, if they say they're going to do one thing and then they don't do it, that's when you just want to open a vein because you realize there's another 10 minutes with this person. The other version is if somebody is super, hey man, I just put it out there in their public life, you know, and then you have them on and say, hey, okay, put it out there. And they go, you know, people have different attitudes about things. Like they completely back away from whatever position or what their book says.
Right.
Or, you know, some women are nice. Yeah. Like, you know, whatever. They they don't, because they see the audience. They see the audience and they'll say one thing on their stupid news show where
nice.
There's no audience to yell at them. But they see my audience and they go, you know, everybody's got their opinions and they're worth, like, that's the worst. People who's kind of play a character.
They lose a little courage when they get in front of the audience, right?
And then will you go after them? Will you sort of like privately resent, like,
privately?
Motherfucker, you're on my show. You should be entertaining. And will you kind of leave them hanging out to dry or will you throw them a lifeline?
Mm. Well, I mean, I'm not there to like stick a knife in anybody.
No,
I don't even on the old gig, I didn't really wasn't there to do that. That was more of a real legend.
Gotcha environment over in your show, Stephen. I've noticed.
Yeah, nobody
it's
wants
a
to
real gotcha. Yeah.
Well, when you're there, when you're there, the general feeling from the staff is fuck him up.
Fuck this guy up.
You know?
I get it.
Fuck Will up.
And
man.
I like it.
And they're like, before I go on stage, they're like, you know, you come back with his liver on a stick, or you fucking don't come back at all because we are hurt by his presence in this building.
Sure.
You know why.
Sure, I do know
and
why.
And I go, I promise you, I'll make him suffer. So I'll tell you someone who actually I have a pleasant hostility with is Jason Bateman.
I'm right
because
here.
Because I've interviewed you a couple of times.
Uh-oh.
And I actually enjoy, there's a pleasant hostility with you as a guest. And I mean pleasant.
What does that mean?
But don't
mean
you feel like there's a
pleasant hostility? Like we don't get along?
Well, you're incredibly pleasant. Like you're such an enjoyable performer.
There comes a but.
But there is.
Yep, there it is.
No, and.
No, you said
and,
but.
Good
there
for
is,
you.
Okay.
Good for you.
All right.
And. Yes.
But
and.
There is.
Okay.
But there is. ..
In addition to your pleasantness and
is.
Your wonderful, charming nature, there's something about you that's a little hostile as a guest.
Yeah, it's anger.
And
listen,
I can't
motherfucker.
Imagine that I,
hang on a second.
I can't imagine I'm the only host who feels this way.
Or friend.
I might be the only one to tell you. I look forward to it. I love a guest who's a little hostile.
Let me just say this for Jason really quickly, because you don't know this, Stephen, but one of the last times that Jason was on your show, he might have been a little hostile because he was going through something.
Yeah. Yeah, let me explain my hostility the last time I was on your show.
You know about this?
I don't think he does know.
I actually don't know. Oh,
okay.
I don't remember anything. thing about the interviews, just that there was a sense, perhaps it's defensiveness, and the hostility is as a rose's thorns. Still beautiful, but defending oneself.
Let me say this. Jason and I were going to do this press thing, and he came, and we were meeting at JFK. He was going to do your show, and he shows up JFK late, and he's a sweaty mess. And they said, how did Colbert go? And he's like, Jesus fucking Christ. Right, Jason?
Is that the setup?
That's yeah.
The setup. Hey, you're great. All right, so here's, first of all, Stephen,
do you want me to tell the story?
No, I got it.
Is this a true story?
This is a true story.
Am I about to hear a
yes.
true story?
Yeah, it's a true story. Now, I will first say, in my defense, I have a British mother who has, she was very sarcastic and dry, and so my sense of humor tends to be a little like that, can come across as hot. Okay, I apologize.
You also have a lot of anger just below the surface.
And I've got some anger below the surface. Okay, so here's the story, Stephen. And I will say, I will apologize to Mr. Jimmy Kimmel right now because I told him about this and he said, oh, you got to say that for the next time you're on. So screw you, Jimmy. I'm going to tell it to Stephen because Stephen owns it because it was on his show. So here's what happened. I come to do your show. I'm in the dressing room there, which, by the way, has no bathrooms, okay? At least the dressing room I got. The dressing room I got, I did not get, then I didn't get the lead guest dressing room. Whatever it was, there's no Johnny in there. So here I am.
They put you in the pit?
They put me in the pit. So I'm in the pit, and my little suit's in there, my little outfit, my little talk show suit's in there. Mm. And everyone gets out of the dressing room so I can change into my suit, and I put it on. And, you know, my wife likes me wearing stuff that's a little tight. And I don't like it, but I guess I lost the battle on this one. So I put it on. It's a little bit tight. And I'm thinking, boy, it could be less tight if I just let a little of this gas out. I just came from dinner, and things have built up a little bit. And I feel like if I could let this one bubble out, things would work out for me.
Again, let me remind the audience, true story.
True story.
All of this is completely true. Keep going.
So
how nice is this suit? How nice is this suit? Armani.
It's, please. What did you say to me?
What is this, 1988?
No, and it's not Hugo Boss either.
They make lovely things.
Something I can't even pronounce probably.
Pierre Cardin? Pierre Cardin?
That's it. So the suit's on, or at least the pants are on, such that I know I need to try to make a little bit more room here. And so I release the valve a little bit. Out comes more than air.
Less than solid. Right.
Now,
no. what are we to airtime at this point? What are we to airtime?
We're four minutes from. You're well done with the monologue. You're probably in commercial break, and it's time to walk. I haven't even got the makeup on yet because the makeup artist is waiting outside the door for me to get the suit on. So this is a problem, and there's a knock on the door. She'd like to get the makeup started. Stage manager would like for us to be walking. So now I've got to get the pants off, get the underwear off, and get rid of the underwear in the bathroom that doesn't exist there. So now I've got to bury the underwear in the trash can. I've got to top it with some Kleenex or something.
A crusty loaf. We usually have some bread and some cheese.
So nobody finds
No one's the wiser. No one can
couple of cans of LaCroix.
So suit's still tight. Now I'm commando. I'm not feeling great about myself. I've forgotten all of my funny answers that I worked on with the segment producer on the pre-interview. Now I'm sweating. I really need makeup. I got David Cross in the dressing room next to me, ready to pre-tape an episode, and he wants to talk. And so I let him in. I tell him what's happened. He thinks it's fantastic. He thinks I should lead with that. I elect not to. I get the makeup on, the powder, whatever. I make it out there, and I sit down, and we do our interview, and that is probably the reason I was less than chatty.
He just shat his pants, Stephen.
You know?
I mean, God. You know.
Okay, now, you want to know why I'm mad? If I hadn't appeared on this podcast today, you would have told that story on Kimmel.
Good for you.
When it's my trash can at my green room.
Good for you.
And my show where that happened, and you were going to tell that story on Kimmel.
That's
if I
totally
come here
entitled
today.
To it's be a good angry. Point. You should be double the angry you are now.
You owe me underwear. Absolutely owe me underwear because.
What size? Are we talking? Are you men's medium? M?
Will?
You're an M.
Will?
He's a boy small. He's a boy small now with his diet. He's a boy small.
All right. What kind do you like?
I like a boxer brief.
Got it.
Okay.
Doesn't crawl up your leg?
Preferably a sort of a rubber saddle to it.
Well, hang on. There's a great question. He just asked you, does it crawl up your leg?
Does it crawl up your leg? Because it crawls up my leg.
No, it doesn't, because the fluid in the seat of it keeps it weighted, keeps it weighted down.
It's a mild adhesive. It's like a post-it note against your ass.
You can imagine we're like, how'd it go on Colbert? Not great, man. Yeah. Not great. I took a shit in my pants and I had to fucking bury my underwear and now we got to get on an all-night flight. And he's like, for fuck's sake, he was like very rattled.
You know what though? We can go down this rabbit hole, no pun intended, because I had a similar thing in grade school. I was in eighth grade. I raised my hand. I had already crapped myself in my jeans. I was 12 years old. I raised my hand. I said, can I go to the bathroom? And she said, yes. I left. I walk into the bathroom. I go into the stall. I take my underwear off. I throw it into the stall underneath next to me.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then I hear the entire football team come into the bathroom. And they go, whoa, dude, what the fuck? Oh, God. And they open the stall next to me. Like, holy shit. Oh, my God. There's shitty underwear. Oh, my God. And I was shaking. I thought I was going to get literally the shit beat out of me again by these people.
Oh, bless.
Don't we all have those stories?
Will, you're up.
Will, you probably never have, right?
Batter up.
No, I'm good.
Will.
I don't think I do.
You've had a history with alcohol. You must have wrecked plenty of shorts.
It wasn't my life wasn't fucking train spotting. Okay, I wasn't shitting beds. But I will say that I did do a similar thing to you, Jason. I was spending the night with a lovely young lady at her apartment years ago, 25 plus years ago in New York City. Just a tremendous date and getting to know you. And woke up in the morning, had a little coffee at her apartment. And and then it got away from me. And I actually ended up opening the small window in her bathroom and throwing my underwear into the courtyard. So... I threw it out of the building.
Steven, we're going to complete the circle and we're going to go ahead
and complete the circle and start the interview.
Sure. I have one story like that. It involves Conan O'Brien.
Sure.
I have one story like that. We were, people always say like, hey, do you good late night guys all know each other? Like, I actually am friends with Conan. It's kind of a late onset friendship in our careers. But we were out, where were we? We were out in Deer Valley, Utah. And I was skiing out there with my family. Uh-oh. And Conan called me up and he said, could I ski with you guys? And I was like, And he said, please, I have no friends and I frighten my family. And could I?
That sounds like Conan.
And I said, okay, all right. And so we met at the top of Silver Strike. You guys know the lift.
Sure.
We met at the top of Silver Strike.
Yeah.
And it's just me and him, because my kids saw him and said, I don't want to ski with him. And they were fans of Leno. And they said, we don't want to ski with Tony. And I made them take a side, because I thought, like, if you want to be in show business, the most important thing in show business is to be in a camp.
That's right.
That's the most, like, talent, okay.
But
or, like, dedication. Yeah. But the most important thing is to pick a camp in Hollywood and never forgive anyone for anything they do.
Right.
And they said, Dad, we can't because we're Leno. And I said, I understand.
Leno.
And I'm proud of you. I said, I'm proud of you.
You're crying right now. It should be pointed out. You're crying telling this story about how proud you are.
And so they went off to do whoever with their mom. Mm-hmm. And they went to go do that, get a big cookie size of their head. And so I get on the lift with Conan, and he is, he loves the sound of his own voice. And so we're riding on the lift and I'm like, shh, we got the masks on. There's a chance for nobody to know who we are. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Because we got the helmet, we got the goggles on, we got the mask. We can actually go out there and enjoy ourselves. And he's like, I'm Conan O'Brien when we're in the lines. And his helmet is the color of his hair. Like, his helmet actually is the color of his hair. Okay. And the back on the back of his Andy Richter's face is stitched into the back of his jacket. And I'm like, this is embarrassing. So we get on, we're on the chair left lift. Gondola, because it's on the lift. We're not, because it's not enclosed, which is a big part of the story. And we're on the lift going up. And he's talking, he's super kind of obsessed with Lou Diamond Phillips at this time.
Sure.
And he's, all he wants to talk about is an officer and a movie. You know that thing on History Channel that Lou Diamond Phillips used to watch, like Kelly's Heroes or something, and then he would interview someone saying, how was that tank battle? Was that accurate? And he's like, why the fuck does Lou Diamond Phillips, like, what did, I know he was in that movie with like Meg Ryan about like something about Denzel Washington, and but why does he get to be the guy who interviews officers? And he will not let it go. He's got okay. Sorry. No, but you know, because he's interviewing these people as if he's had military service. When he always like, he does like a heel turn and salutes and shit like that. So Conan won't shut about Lou Diamond Phillips the entire time. And we're going over, and I know how you're going up and you'll be going others. You're going over ski runs.
Yeah.
And this is out west where like, it might take you 20 minutes to get to the top of the mountain. Yeah. So you're looking at other people and you're judging the way they ski and everything. And Conan, he sees like a little, one of these little like a conga line kind of like toddler ski class going by. And he goes, I bet I could take a dump on those kids. And I said, don't even joke about that.
Those are my children and their mother.
That's not nice. That's not right. No, they weren't my kids. But there was like, you know, it was like whatever, like they call it the reindeer club or whatever it is, right. You know. And they got the clips on the front of their skis, so they have to be in the pizza French fry the entire time. Exactly right. Which is how Conan skis, by the way. It's all pizza. It's all pizza French fry, which isn't easy at his height. Right. And so we're going over one of these runs. I don't know. It's like Homeward Bound or whatever. One of those things like that. You know the names of the runs up there. And Conan's like, I bet I could do that. And I said, please don't try. And he said, too late. Sounds like you're daring me. And I'm like, you're in a full length. You're in like a neck to ankle, like one piece jumpsuit. How are you going to do this? And he goes, zip. He's got a flap in the back. And he just scoots it out. He scoots it out over the back.
Oh, my God.
I swear, hand to God, he yells, Torah, Torah, Torah.
That's his shit war and cry.
He yells Torah, 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 and just like, have you ever seen like those movies where like a like some sort of rescue squad has to put down a marker in the snow so a helicopter can find you? Like, it's like,
or it's like the flame retardant coming out of the planes.
It's the same. It's the same color as his hair.
No way.
100%. A bright orange waste comes out of Conan.
100%.
It's like he lives just on Dorito dust, and it just absolutely. He dropped it like when he drops it like one of those planes in firefighting.
Sure.
And literally knocks these kids down.
Lesson over.
Absolutely knocks them down.
Oh my God.
And with just a high pitched cackle. And I'm like, are you okay? That is not. And again, the color again was like, remember when Conan, before he wore the wigs?
Yes.
Now it's all when he still had hair.
Right. Yeah. Sure.
Before. And he's all proud. And I got to say, I'm impressed.
Of course.
I got to say, a man his age, that control. That's
incredible. This is 100% true.
100%. It happened.
100% true.
Yeah.
He might remember the story differently than I do. And we've never talked about it. We've never talked about it since. From that moment, we never talked about it. We made a promise. He looked at me, and his pride, it went from like pride to deep shame.
Sure.
He goes, I want you to swear that not only did you not see that, like you'll never say anything, but you'll never say we went skiing together. And I said, I won't ever say anything about us skiing together if you never say anything about
it. Even that day?
From that second. Didn't happen.
Fuck around.
We so appreciate the trust.
And one of the reasons was because we get to the top, and obviously, who's up there? Cops. Yeah. Like, they're like, because that is.
I thought you were going to say Lou Diamond Phillips. Jesus Christ, what a ride. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp.
If you're feeling depressed or struggling with relationships or having difficulty sleeping or meeting your goals, BetterHelp offers online professional counselors who can listen and help. I suffer from depression and anxiety. I'm sure lots of people have felt that during the pandemic the last year or so. And so I'm here to tell you it really, really works. And they're just fantastic.
Sean, I totally agree. And I think that this year, more than ever, it's kind of highlighted how important it is to stay connected and to get the help that you need and really take that first step to do that for yourself.
Yeah,
it's such
that.
A great gift for your mental well-being and your mental health.
For sure.
And the ability to do it online, that you can reach out online and find a counselor online and connect with them and text with them or talk to them or have a video session, all that stuff. The fact that we actually have that and people can have access to that, it's so great, especially in this time.
I love that.
And the great thing is, as part of that, BetterHelp will assess your needs and, you know, match you with your own licensed professional therapist.
Yeah, and just to be clear, it's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online.
And the service is available for clients worldwide.
Yeah, super simple. You just log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor.
And you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you don't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room, you know, as like with traditional therapy.
Right. Plus, it's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid, if you need it, is available.
And our listener gets 10% off their first month of online therapy at BetterHelp.com/smartless.
Visit BetterHelp.com/smartless and join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced BetterHelp professional.
You know what, Sean?
Yeah.
Look, I want you to rethink everything you know about getting healthy, because all that stuff that you ever learned, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of contradictory information out there. You remember that old-fashioned food pyramid?
Yeah. I still use it.
Not much help. No, it's not much help. We always thought that we had to do this and that and less salt
and, like,
and less
a lot
carbs
bread.
And diet and do this. And if I don't eat for this amount of hours and then I have this, and if I don't eat sugar after 2 p.m. and all that stuff, blah, 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 noise, record scratch, eat. Mm-hmm. Enter Noom.
It's not about what you just ate, but it's about how you eat in general. So Noom teaches you about eating, your cravings, and how to build new habits so you can ditch your misconceptions and get smart, not smartless, about food and the choices you make.
Well, it's based in psychology, okay, Sean? And I don't want to be too heavy-handed about it, but Noom teaches you how to eat so that you can accomplish your personal health goals and stick with them long-term.
So with Noom, you pick the health goals that are right for you, and Noom personalizes a weight loss program to help your aspirations become reality. Now, for me, when I use Noom, I know for a fact I have more energy, I can exercise better, I can fit in my clothes, and because of that, I'm more confident and comfortable in a social gathering, the limited ones we have, I feel more confident because of Noom.
And it's giving you confidence, which is great. That's because Noom's cognitive behavioral approach means you're not just losing weight, you're building the habits you need to keep it off.
Yeah, there's a science to getting healthier, and it's called Noom. So sign up for your trial today at Noom, that's Noom.com/smartless.
Learn how to eat again with Noom. Sign up for your trial today at Noom, Noom.com/smartless. Ready to learn how to live healthier? I think you are. Sign up for Noom today at Noom.com/smartless.
So let's begin the interview.
Sure. Yeah. And I just want to say, I do want to add one more thing if I can before we start the interview. Yeah. And none of this is recorded, right? Would not please.
No. This is all rehearsal. Yeah, this is all pretty show.
The one thing I want to say is that, again, as we remember things differently, and he'll remember it differently than I do if he ever talks about it again, is that the one thing I know happened is the Lou Diamond Phillips shit talk. That's the one thing. I'm not sure about the rest of it.
Steven, welcome to the show.
Steven.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you. And I love your short stories. They're going to cut together great. so listen,
great to meet you.
I I have been such a fan for so long. We don't have to go through your whole, I mean, I people might find it interesting. I know they would. I know I would, but I don't want to bore you with you. So I want to know, though, the trajectory of the Late Show with Stephen Colbert, because I feel like when the show now feels like it's different than when it began a little bit.
It's different than it was a year ago.
Yeah. Did you at the beginning, did you feel like you had to conform into Letterman's kind of format or any pressure like that, and then realized, wait a minute, I need to do my own thing here? Like, what steered it in the direction it is today?
Just trying a whole bunch of different stuff. Like, when I started, I had never been myself before. I was like, I'm not a host. I like hosting parties, but I'm not a host. I didn't know what that was. I'd always, even the Colbert Report, that was a 10-year sketch.
Right.
Like, I did a 10-year scene. I was doing a character. Really, like, that guy and I are not the same guy.
Right.
And I worked really hard to never leave character. Like, I worked really hard. Like, before I went on stage every night, I'd slap myself in the face hard. Mm. Like, really, just to wake myself up. And I'd look in the mirror and go, hey, don't drop it now. Like, you've been carrying this plate of glasses for, like, 6 years. Don't drop it now. What was the purpose of carrying it for 6 years? So I tried to stay really, you know, it's a character you wear as lightly as a hat, as the saying goes, lightly as a cap, but I still try to keep it on. Then I go over and then I go, okay, so me, what do I want to do? I don't know. So I just kept doing different things for, I'd say 6 months. And then one of the things I was doing at the same time was actually show running the show. I didn't have a showrunner. It was me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Which I had the old show. And I thought I could do both. And I kind of lost my mind. I'm like, I can't. I'm not thinking at all about what I want to do comedically. Lot. I'm thinking about running the show.
I got to say, Stephen, it really struck me. I noticed one of the last times I went there, we did a bit, and I came in a little bit early. We rehearsed it, and then I got a knock on the door, and one of your writers, somebody on the show said, hey, we're downstairs. Stephen's rewriting the bit right now if you want to come down, because he's kind of changing it. And I was so shocked by how close it was to showtime, and you were downstairs, and you were driving, you were at the computer, and you were the one who was doing it and taking ideas from everybody, and you were the one who was actually physically changing the bit yourself. And I thought, wow, that is so, what a high wire act. You're about to go out and do the show.
Oh, I still do that. That never changed.
That's incredible.
I'm talking about the show business side of it. Like, I literally had somebody, I take all the show business side of it. So all I could think about was the comedy. And then that changed the way I did my entire day, which let me just think about, okay, I'm just a comedian and a performer here. And that's when I found out what I liked and what I didn't like about what I was doing.
But that level of control was like, it was, you...
I mean, I can't imagine not like working on it till the last minute.
Right.
I can't imagine that, because every day is this metaphor John Stewart and I used to use back when I used to work with that guy. Is it's like a distillery. Like, the morning you get the pitches, that's like the corn. And then you mash it with the first draft. And then you take that mash and you check the alcohol level. Mm-hmm. And you go, okay, let's rewrite it. That's actually to put it in the little thing and to get the pure alcohol out of it. And then the last rewrite, that thing in the room right before you go on, that's where you try to make it the way I would say it. Then you try to get it in your own mouth feel. And that mouse feels like that's oak aging or something, you know, that's putting in the barrel. So it turns into whiskey, and you can't always do that,
right.
But it's always the goal. I'd hate to not try. And it's not like you look at it and go like, oh shit, that's brandy every night. Sometimes it's just moonshine, but you want to try to make it brandy if you can.
Do you ever show up and it's in great shape right off the bat?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Because there's a process that happens before I ever see it. There's the pitch in the morning, which I always hear.
Yeah.
And I weigh in on which of those I like. You know, we might get 8 pitches and guys will write on 5 or 4 of them. And
so, sorry, what does that mean? You get 8 pitches of jokes or 8 pitches of ideas to do as
areas, stories, like, because this is
for monologue or for after monologue?
This is for a monologue. Yeah. I mean, there are other refillables that get written more like buckets, you know, like, they're not as timely.
Yeah.
But the monologue, that first 15 minutes of the show, that is, for lack of a better word, like, that's the national conversation.
Right.
What are people talking about today? Uh-huh. And we don't dictate that. We literally have a guy we stole from Anderson Cooper, this wonderful researcher named Brandon. And we go, Brandon, what's the conversation? Where are the news trucks in the world right now?
Right.
Because I'm going to talk about that thing that the audience has heard all day anyway and have their own anxiety about it.
What's the deadline on that?
we record the show at 5:30. Cutoff is about 5.
Right.
We have a late breaker team. We have a team that starts writing around 3 o'clock-ish. And the late breakers, before we put the script to bed around 5 or 5:15, we go, late breakers got any mini chunks, we call it? Anybody? Anything getting chunky upstairs? We got any mini chunks? And then we go, oh, we got maxi chunks because there was just a press conference or a new vaccine just came through or whatever it is. What's going to lead all the cable news tonight,
right,
uh-huh, is what we're thinking. What's the lead? Because that may not be what we lead our monologue with. We might lead with something silly that just sort of like puts a little gas in the engine for the audience. But we're going to talk about whatever it is. We try not to ignore whatever the thing, even if it's tragic, sadly,
right,
because we don't make jokes about it, but we don't want to say like, hey, we didn't have the same experience you had as an audience, mm-hmm, tonight. Mm-hmm. That process took about 6 months to create, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, the way we do it. And we've been doing that for about five years now.
Sean mentioned at the top when he was introducing you that you were at Second City in Chicago. I know that you were part of that whole gang. Who are your kind of your contemporaries when you were in Chicago? Because everybody has kind of different classes that they were with.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Well, there's two different things. There's the people you watched.
Yeah, right.
Who you wanted to be your contemporaries, and then there's the people you performed with.
Yeah.
But in your mind, those people you watched are also
sure,
like the people you were watching, like. The people I watched, the people who I first saw improvise, actually, not at Second City, but at this little club in Chicago called Cross Currents. It was called Cross Currents, and it was under the Belmont L, and just really, really divey little place. Dave Pasquazi, do you know guys like Dave?
Yeah.
Pasquazi was the first guy I ever saw, and I went, oh, I want to do that. Uh-huh. Whatever he's got, I want that. That little secret he has when he walks on stage. I don't know what it is, but I always want to know what it is. I'm like, how can you... Today, I still like. I kind of still want to be Dave Pasquazi, especially his ability to improvise. But who else was there? Mike Myers was on stage, and Tim Meadows was
Steve
on
Carell,
stage.
Steve Carell, right?
No, Carell was essentially my same generation. Oh. He was about a year ahead of me. Second City works like a rep.
Right. Yeah.
Like you come in and you learn like the last 40 years of material and you do that on the road. Uh-huh. He was in that process like 6 months to a year ahead of me in that process.
And what about like Amy Sedaris?
So hired on the same day because there's a big casting call every year. Like they 300 people come in and they pick like 5, 4, or 6. My year, the people who were hired that August were, which was 1988, I guess. It was me, Rose Abdu, Amy Sedaris,
hilarious.
Paul Dinello, hilarious. And Chris Farley.
Hilarious. Wow.
Wow. Wow.
And Greg Holloman, but Chris Farley. So first 6 months I toured with Farley.
God, I
toured around the country.
He could do no wrong to me. Funniest guy.
You know, people don't talk about Farley enough. Mm-hmm. People don't. Like,
I agree.
He deserves a deeper memory. Mm-hmm. In comedy.
Well, he's written off as just kind of like this big, dumb, sort of goofy who did big physical stuff, but there was such a purpose there. It was so sharp, right?
He is. You're right. That's how he's written off. Not a dumb guy.
And it's so specific and so, and it was so spot on and it was so specific, right?
So spot on. He and Sedaris had this thing. Like, I remember that I saw them before I worked with them. I saw them on stage. Because we were hired, but they were actually placed in the company first. And so I was literally still like waiting tables there. And I saw both of them on stage and I went, who are those people? Uh-huh. First thing I ever saw Amy say is she walked on stage, door bursts open, there's this tiny little bundle of energy. And she goes, oh my God, you've got a wet bar. And just starts clapping like that and runs over and goes, now I want to see the cocktail she's going to make. And I went, I want to work with her. And then
and
me and Paul and Amy ended up essentially working together almost every day for like 17 years.
And you created Strangers with Candy.
We were like, we were in a common law marriage for the next 17
years.
It's
great. And Strangers with Candy is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
I heard that once you described Amy as like an idiot savant without the savant. Is that true? As a joke. To her.
Oh no, she knows.
Yeah, yeah.
She knows. No, I think that might be her own accurate. That might be her own interpretation of herself. She would sit in the corner as we would like write Strangers with Candy. And of course, everything is written for her and around her. It's all built around like, what can we build around her?
Yeah.
And Paul and I, it'd be like 3 o'clock in the morning and we'd be slapping on the keys going, okay, where do we go with this? And we'd be just sitting there in like the horror of the clock whizzing on the wall, like the hands going around, like, we have to shoot this tomorrow. And then Amy would go like, but what if it was a squirrel? And we'd go, what? She's like, what did I say? I'm like, you said something about a squirrel.
Yeah,
squirrel.
Right.
She would, and it would be exactly the right thing in that moment. Uh-huh. And she wouldn't necessarily know that she had absorbed every problem we were trying to surmount. And she would just blurt out exactly the right answer, exactly when we needed it. So the wheels are always turning uh-huh. inside that little coconut-sized skull of hers. But
she, and she's one of those people who makes me laugh more than any. I can't. She's like a drug to me.
Yeah, I love it too. But speaking of that, Stephen, like, just thinking really fast, you have such a fast brain. I love that you're like, you know, wishing you were had great as great of improv skills as some of the people you grew up with, but you do. I mean, your brain works so fast. Is it frustrating
to be with people like you who aren't as fast as I am?
Really slow.
Is this agony to actually be doing anything with you, to deign,
are
to
you
condescend,
biting your nails? Yeah.
To appear on your podcast?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Are you ripping paper?
No, I am enjoying myself.
No, but is it frustrating being around people who don't think as fast as you, or work as fast as you, or work as hard as you, or anything like that?
No, I actually don't think of myself as that great of an improviser. I mean, I know a lot of people who are better than I am, because I don't think it's necessarily about being fast. I think it's being, like, honestly reactive, because, mm-hmm. you know, not to get too spiritual here, but the first guy I took any classes with was Del Close. Mm-hmm. And while there are people have their own opinions or pros and cons about, you know, Del Close, I don't have much of an experience with him. But one thing he said was that, don't think that it's you. Uh-huh. Don't think it's you that have to do this. You actually have to be reactive, and just the universe is going to do it. Yeah. You're if you actually do it right, it's just happening. You won't know who did it if you do it right. And I think that's sort of, in some ways, the opposite of quickness.
Uh-huh.
That's vulnerability. And there are people who are great vulnerable performers who I'm incredibly jealous of, because I still have a need to please, and that can get in the way of me actually being a good improviser, because you want to score.
Don't you consider what you do on your show, your conversations with people as improv?
I mean, I do. Sure.
You know, being able to just be on your feet and be listening, and then...
Yeah, it's not... I mean, I think to me, the old show was more like improv, because there was a character choice, and then you were making performance choices in the moment. That was really improvisation. This one, I really, especially now in COVID, I just try to actually have a conversation with someone.
It must be kind of harder now, just being yourself in a certain way, than... spending all those years where you were playing a character and getting, now it's because you have to be much more honest, again, without being too sort of, you know, corny, but you're being much more, just being yourself and being vulnerable in that way is probably more difficult. Yes or no?
It was for me.
Yeah.
It is for me. I mean, now I wouldn't want to do that old guy.
Right, right.
Uh-huh. I mean, I didn't want to do that old guy anymore anyway. That's why I left. It's not like I got fired. I still liked doing him, but I wanted to leave while I still liked it. And I never intended to be doing what I'm doing right now. Matter of fact, I already made the decision to leave that show before I was offered this one. This was 100% a happy accident.
Oh, wow.
I had a whole other plan. I had a whole other thing I was going to do.
What was that plan? What were you going to do?
I still want to do it, so I don't want to steal it. But I honest to God, that's how showbiz I am.
It's registered trademark.
I was going to put that character into a narrative. I was going to put that character into an honest to God, like, half-hour comedy.
You should. Oh, but sure. You still can do that.
I wanted to follow what he was going to do next.
Yeah, but nobody can steal that idea, because you play the
comedy
guy.
Half-hour comedy starring, like, sort of like the character from Colbert Report.
Well,
single camera or multi-camera.
I can tell you what was going to go with it, is that in 2012, what gave me the idea was that I had all this money because I started a super PAC. I raised $1.3 million. Right. Which scared the bejesus out of me, by the way. We started as a game. Like, I on the old show, I like to always just do everything real, you know? Uh-huh. And as my publicist once said to me, Carrie Bylock, my dear friend, she once said to me, hey, I need to ask about this running for president thing. Everybody's calling me, and I just want to get, you know, everything nailed down here so I understand. Is this a joke, or are you running for real? And I said, well, if it wasn't real, it wouldn't be a joke. She goes, Got it. And that was the way we did it. I wanted to do everything for real. I really had a super PAC. I really wanted to raise money, because I really wanted to see, I wanted to be the joke. The character was
right,
the joke.
Right, right.
What made it easier for me is that anytime you would approach a subject, there is a base coat of joke because the character's a joke.
Right.
Yeah,
I could approach any subject and there would always be some level of comedy.
Of course.
Because the character would be the joke. And now there always has to be a joke. And that's what's harder about now. I don't have to turn that extra knob to do the character. And there are times when I really do enjoy being myself. And I actually enjoy interviewing people more as myself.
Right.
But I think it requires more of my writers in a way because they actually – our joke per minute ratio has to be much better because it's setups and punchlines.
Right. You know what, guys? We're not there yet, but a return to semi-normal looks kind of like it might be on the horizon. And that all sounds great until you realize that you've put on 20 pounds in the past year and will eventually have to go out in public again at some point. So for everyone that's trading donuts for dumbbells, hi, our good friends at CBDMD have exactly what you need to recover fast and keep moving towards your goals. CBD Freeze with menthol offers fast-acting temporary cooling relief for minor aches and pains in a convenient and easy-to-use roller or shareable squeeze tube. CBD Recover combines CBD with the blood flow enhancing compound histamine dihydrochloride to temporarily relieve minor aches and pains and give you support you need where it matters most. Now, I've used it on my back and I have a little rotator cuff on my left shoulder, and I used it like that. It took away the pain and the aches, and it was awesome. It makes it easy to relax, regroup, and recover. And right now, they're offering our listener 25% off your next order when you use the promo code SMARTLESS at checkout. Once again, that's CBDMD.com, promo code SMARTLESS for 25% off your purchase of high-quality CBD oil products from CBDMD. Hey, if you've been listening to Smartless for a while, you've probably heard us talk about our Helix mattresses, which basically we live in. They're that comfortable. For me personally, I love my Helix mattress. It's like I sleep like a baby. It's the best sleep I've ever had.
Yeah, I love my Helix mattress too. It's been such a game changer since we got them. And that's why we're so excited to tell you that Helix has left the bedroom and started making sofas. Who saw that coming?
Not me.
They just launched a new company called Allform, and they're already making the best sofas in the game.
Yeah, with Allform, you can pick your fabric, the sofa color, the color of the legs, sofa size, and shape to make sure it's perfect for you and your home.
They've got armchairs and love seats all the way up to an 8-seat sectional, so there's something for everyone.
Allform sofas are also delivered directly to your home with fast, free shipping. In the past, if you wanted to order a sofa, it could take weeks or even months to arrive, and you would need someone to come and assemble it in your home.
Allform is so easy to assemble. You can put it together yourself in a few minutes. No tools needed. So, you know, my friend Bobby, who's a total tool, doesn't need to show up.
Yeah, I have an Allform armchair. I customized it to the whiskey leather fabric and walnut colored legs. It's in my living room and I love it.
It's funny you say that, Sean, because I was going for a different style and I got my Allform chaise in the sand fabric and espresso colored legs. I just moved it into my bedroom and I love it. Yeah.
And if getting a sofa without trying it in a store sounds a little risky, you don't need to worry. You get 100 days to decide if you want to keep it. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up for free and give you a full refund.
You know, Allform, they even offer a forever warranty. Literally, forever.
I love that. Finally, we get the comfort of our Helix mattresses in our living room.
To find your perfect sofa, check out allform.com/smartless.
And Allform is offering 20% off all orders for our listener at allform.com/smartless.
Sean, I think you would agree that these are kind of weird times that we've been living in. And I know that a lot of people have struggled in lots of different ways, and it's just been such a toss-up. But I don't know if you knew this, but one of the kind of great byproducts of this time is there's been a total boom in adoptions on pups.
It's awesome.
Dogs.
I love it.
It's so exciting. But you might not know a lot about or anything about your new dog, right? So there's this new brand, Embark. And Embark's breed and health kit is a really good tool now that you can have to help you really know all about your pup, new or old. I remember the first dog that I adopted, my dog Charlotte, who passed away many years ago. She was just my pal, and she was great. And she kind of looked like a lab, and she kind of looked like, but she had coloring of a pointer, and then she had these crazy big paws, but she was kind of short. It was one of those things I wish that I kind of had been able to go back and find out, you know, a lot more about her origin.
I'm super excited to get my own kit, which I haven't gotten yet, from Embark, and test it out on my doggy and see what's what. And you should try it too if you haven't, if you're curious like we are. There's so many benefits to it. First of all, it's developed by PhDs and veterinarians, so it's totally legit. It's the most accurate breed identification and genetic health results out there, and it can identify over 350 breeds of dogs. So just knowing the genetic health conditions of your dog can help and just give you more insight so you can take better care of your pup.
And every time they do that, like every dog that actually gets tested, they use that knowledge and they pump it into their research, and it helps discover and treat new genetic diseases in all other dogs to kind of help extend the lives of other dogs.
Yeah,
which is really rad.
All right, so get this. Embark has been working on their annual Mutt Madness campaign. It takes place every March. And this campaign highlights 16 adoptable dogs from 16 different rescue organizations. It's awesome.
And website visitors vote for their favorite, and the winning dog receives a donation of up to $5,000 for their rescue organization. How amazing is that,
Chuck? I love that. Right now, Embark has an offer on their breed and health kit for our listener. Go to EmbarkVet.com now to get free shipping and save $50 off your Embark breed and health kit with promo code SMARTLESS.
Visit EmbarkVet.com and use promo code SMARTLESS to save $50 today.
And now back to the show.
Do you give yourself the credit that you deserve for being such a great actor by playing that character as well as you did, with no winking, no nut, to the point where...
By the way, Jason, sorry, for Tracy in Wisconsin, we're talking about the Colbert Report, just
right,
so people know what we've never said what, we just keep saying the character.
Where you played a very fervent right-wing, what would you call it?
Pundit.
Guy, yeah. So
pundit.
That took acting skills.
Hold on 1 second, yeah. I'm going to interrupt you,
please.
I'm the host. Sean, I question whether Tracy in Wisconsin... Yeah. Hearing Colbert Report, if that helps her any more than knowing that I'm Stephen Colbert and saying character. Because if they don't know Stephen Colbert used to do a character, I don't think Colbert Report is going to tip them off.
Okay, just calm down about all of that and let's just keep going.
Wow.
I'm trying to give you the hostility,
yeah,
that I get.
I got it. It's coming
Jason,
through.
You know
it's
what
coming
I mean?
Through.
I'm just
and that's
forward.
The cycle of abuse. That's the cycle,
right,
of abuse.
Still trying to finish, right, my goddamn question.
Oh,
Stephen.
Well, we'd love you to fucking start it.
Hey, Stephen. Hi. So given all of that great raw acting talent, do you have any desire to play characters, like have like a acting career,
yeah, sure,
in and,
yeah,
around your show?
In and around my show. Now, the show takes all of my time. You know, like I'd much rather produce other people's shows. I'd much rather take this and help people the way I was helped. That's what I'd like to do, like, while I'm doing my show. I think to really do a good job, I'd have to, like, stop doing the show. And I enjoy doing the show. I don't want to be... I don't think I could do, like, a side hustle as an actor.
But could you see yourself doing, like you were just mentioning, you know, the show that you wanted to do based on your character from Colbert Report? Could you imagine,
yeah,
taking that character and producing it and potentially writing it and whatever and running it and having another actor, say, like a Lou Diamond Phillips, playing you...
Mm.
Is that something that you would consider? And again, knowing
now,
that...
wait a second. I was going to say no.
Okay.
I was going to say no.
And then I said...
Until you said Lou Diamond Phillips.
Mm-hmm. Just to get under,
right,
Conan's...
There could be a natural sort of war angle to it as well.
Just knowing that Conan is,
right,
so mad at him. Because Conan's like, where does,
right,
he get off, right?
Conan could do like a guest arc, like a stunt arc on it. It's producing,
right,
itself.
So, but could you... No, but all bits aside, could you see yourself producing like that idea that you had that you wanted for you... Producing it
for somebody else.
Yeah,
I mean, not that. I'd rather do something else, because that I specifically, there was things I wanted to do with him that were ways. What I liked about him was how he clanged up against the real world,
yeah,
like going out into the real world, and it really upset people almost every time I did it.
It was so fun.
And now I honestly, I like people to like me as much as the next person.
Sure.
And so now, honest to God,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know, I actually don't. I love the audience. I don't, some people have like a hostile relationship to their audience. Like, I never feel like it's the audience's fault,
mm-hmm,
if the show doesn't,
yeah,
go well.
Yeah.
I never blame them. It's always me. That's my job.
Right.
They're amateurs.
Exactly,
I'm a professional.
Yeah.
And so I like people to like me. And so this is such a different job. Whereas that old job, it was okay if they didn't like me. That was kind of the purpose of him going out into the world was to see what this kind of character would be clanging up in his most extreme state with real people who weren't in on it.
And given that, do you think in today's political climate that you could do that show today?
No,
I don't think. I think it would poke the bear too much, wouldn't it?
I think it would be too dark. I think our political climate has gotten. I could feel it. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to leave. Is I no longer wanted to, as I said before, that I no longer wanted to sip that cup of poison because you had to sip a little bit of it. You had to titrate it a little bit to go do the character.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't even look at those people anymore. And now, I would never. Can you imagine having to leapfrog the guy who was just to be worse than him?
No, I know.
Because he literally quoted my old character at times, literally like word for word.
What's the reaction you get when you go back to the South? You're from the South.
I'm from South Carolina. All roads lead north from South Carolina.
Sure,
nice.
Sure,
that's good.
What's it like? It's fine. I mean, I don't know.
You still
know,
family there?
Yeah. And I married a girl from there. So like, there's no debate about where we go when we have time. Right. And we like have a place, we have a house like right across the street from her sister. It's like really,
oh, that's great.
And her parents live in a block and a half away. And my sister lives about a half a mile away. And so
when you show up in town, you don't have to wear a heavy disguise for protection.
No, I don't think I'm happy to say, I don't think anybody cares about me.
Yeah.
Right.
We do.
I don't get fanned at and I don't get hostiled at. I'm just
unless I'm sitting in the guest chair.
And, right. And is anybody, because you come from a large family like me, but not as nearly as large as yours. Is anybody else in the family, like, first of all, 11 kids you grew up with? So there's got to be a gay one in there. And
not that we know of.
All right, well, hang on.
Not that we know of.
Hang in there.
The door is open.
Sure.
Door is open.
But what?
What
was it like growing up in such a massive organization?
Normal. You know, whatever happens to your childhood is normal.
Right.
So it felt perfectly normal. It wasn't until I had no sense of it until I was in first grade. So I'm in first grade, and the very first day of first grade, Mrs. Poole, I think her name was, and we all had to sit up on the back of our seat, like with our butts are on the back of our seat, our feet are in the seat of the seat, and we're all to sit up there. And she's going to hold up her fingers. And when she gets to the number of children in your family, sit down because she's trying to get to know us.
Sure, right.
And she gets to 10 and I'm still sitting up on the back of my seat.
Wow.
And she thinks that I can't count.
Right.
She's like, I'm the troubled child. Because that's why she's doing it, to see if kids know how to count.
Uh-huh.
And
wow.
This is 1969 South Carolina. This is just like two steps away from To Kill a Mockingbird, this community I'm in. And the Yules live right around the corner. And so that's when I found out that it was unusual that you had that many kids in your family.
And are you trying to replicate that? Do you have a bunch of kids running around there? How many do you have?
I'm trying to, but so far, just three.
Just the three.
Uh-huh. Just three, but I'm not giving up.
Do they know what you do?
And my wife is listening. I am not giving up.
Do they?
We're both in our late 50s, but you know what? Have you heard of Abraham?
Yeah, this is very threatening, man. Again, you might want to bring the tone down. Go ahead, Jason. Yeah.
Do they know what you do? Do they appreciate you, your humor? Do they give it up, or is it the toughest audience in the world, like the rest of us?
It's a tough audience.
Yeah,
it's a tough audience. I mean, I think they appreciate what Dad does. Yeah. Tough audience. Mm-hmm. Evie's still a good audience. That's nice. She's my audience now because I got no audience. When she comes in and sits in the extra little red chair in the storage closet where I'm doing the late show right now, that's it. Like, that's as good. I mean, I actually said this on the show the other night. When I started off, I thought, like, God, I wish I could make an audience laugh the way I make Evie laugh. Like, I could make it. But honest to God, because it was like I could feel like the honesty and like the intimacy. Because really, that intimacy, like, what do you want? You like, there's a sense of community with an audience if you get it right.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And now she's it. That's it. Like, she's the one I'm making laugh. And it's kind of joyful and kind of wonderful. And as sad as the last year has been, that's been a marvelous thing. Because the kids were my crew down in South Carolina. We bugged out 1 year ago yesterday. We left the Ed Sullivan Theater.
Yeah. Wow.
And we went down to South Carolina to help take care of her folks who are like, you know, in their 90s. And they couldn't have anybody come in and help them. So it was just, you know, really Evie and her sister taking care of them. So we were down there right down the street and we couldn't let crew into the house. We had a satellite truck parked on the front lawn, killing the grass. And they ran cables in through a spare bedroom window. Well, we packed foam around it, tried to keep the bugs out. And I put a kitchen stool next to an old desk from her family. And there was a TV in there. I could put graphics up on it. And the first thing is my middle son, my daughter's, you know, in her 20s and out there with a job. But she was working. She was like working online in the kitchen. And my eldest son was my crew for the first couple months.
Wow.
And then he's like, he was finishing up college. He's like, I'm literally not going to graduate if I keep doing this, Dad. So his younger brother, who was finishing up high school, both of them robbed of their senior years. Yeah. You know, they're worse things, but I felt bad for him. Then he took over in tag team. And then both of them are like, Mom, like, I won't graduate from high school. So then Evie took over. And then she was my crew, and which was just kind of great. And it was really like the old 19th century. Yeah. Everybody's going to pitch in and help Dad down at the lumber mill because we've got the pine, you know, the new lodgepole pines are coming in. We got to make flooring or whatever they did in the 19th century. So did they laugh at the jokes? No. Evie would laugh at the jokes. But I don't think my boys cracked a smile for 5 months because that's how long we did it. But they weren't really paying attention either.
Right.
But what they did, because they were just doing the technical aspects of it. But it was like lighting, sound, cameras, switching over like channels and everything, communicating with the people they're on the headset, talking to the virtual control room.
Basically a live show.
No way.
Live show. Yeah. I'm 100%. Great. The kids are on the headset going, hold on, Dad, we're switching satellites or whatever. That's what my boys are doing for me.
Wow.
And then my daughter's doing my makeup. Wow. And then
CBS catches wind and they go, oh, we could do this a lot cheaper.
Well, we actually had to get a union waiver. It was like an emergency.
Of course.
Like you literally, because it was emergency COVID, the union said, okay, you can do this. But it was kind of an amazing thing. But they got to see I loved it because I think it's very helpful for everybody to become an adult to see their parents as human.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, I lost my dad when I was pretty young and I was robbed of that ability to see him as not Olympian, to see him as a human being.
Right. Yeah.
And so like that, there's something stunting about your development if you don't get to see your parents as human. And they 100% saw their dad as human going like literally like in the middle of a monologue, just throwing my glasses across the room going, I don't know how the fuck I'm supposed to do this with no audience and like no sense of timing. Like I took the goddamn job at the Late Show, not because I had ever really like harbored this dream of being a late night talk show. Cause this is a real late night. Like I didn't know what this job was like until I did. No idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, my respect for like the Jimmys and the Conans and your Daves and your Jays and your Johnnies and your Steve Allens and your Jack Parrs and your Dick Cavetts I already liked them. I'd never had it. Like I already liked them, but my respect went through the roof and went, oh my God, this is a really hard job. Uh-huh. And it's not anything like you think.
Are you still loving doing it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I want the audience back, but it wasn't on the bucket list to do this gig. Right. And when I was offered, I went, God, it's the only fucking promotion I could think of is to take that job and no one's ever going to offer to me again. I'll give it a shot.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I love a live audience. Thinking of it that morning and doing it that night and finding out because the audience makes the special sound with their mouths and you know that worked and you get to pull another piece of Kleenex out of the box tomorrow. That's what I love about it. And I've been doing it for a year now with none of that. Yeah. And my kids got to see the guy crump. For the first 2 weeks, I kind of like just imploded in front of the camera. And then I went, okay, stop complaining. This is what it is. And then I found some real enjoyment in it. I found actually an ability to like take some risks that I couldn't with a live audience.
Sure. Yeah.
That's all.
And it made me think of Jason too, because you said you know, your daughter did your makeup and Jason's daughters do his makeup every morning before he goes to the mall or whatever. And I think that's nice too, to have that connection. You know what I mean?
We got to connect once a day. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
You're dying to get back to audiences then, right? When do you think that'll happen? Probably in the next 2-3 months, right?
Somewhere between 3 months and 3 years from now, because you keep on getting these different messages from people. But I think people are getting shots so quickly now. You know, when people can like show proof of vaccination and we can do there are like 7-minute rapid tests coming down the pipe. When we can do that,
right?
And I can have 400 people I want to go back on that stage like I left that.
Yeah, I bet that's June. I mean, now that Biden said May 1st, everyone's going to qualify. It's June, right? Middle of June?
Yeah, June, July, maybe after the 4th of July, something like that. Because if Biden says we can all get together for small parties, you know, in 4th of July, I think it's reasonable by mid-July because we're off for those first two weeks. By mid-July, we might be able to do that. But I don't hold me to that because I don't have any idea.
Oh, well, I don't know who else to hold it to.
Yeah, me neither. I kind of feel like so it comes down on you, man, a little bit.
We'll come back to you and ask you what happened. What went wrong.
If it doesn't go the right way.
Have you guys ever talked to Conan? Because he talks a lot.
We talked to Conan.
We cut him off, though.
Word.
We cut a fucking...
I want you to promise me you're not going to broadcast that.
You have our word.
Conan, because I promised him. I promised him.
Wait, about Conan, about the ski trip?
That about on the ski. He said, I beg you, never say anything because this will ruin me.
Yeah, no, we've already cut that.
This will ruin
you. You have our word.
You are a very, very generous man with your time, with your spirit, your stories, and your laughter, Stephen.
Oh, Stephen. Dude, thank you so much. It's so funny.
Thank you very, very much for doing this.
Thank you, Stephen.
This was so fun, you guys. This was worth burning a couple hours on a Saturday.
Good, I hope so.
Yeah, we appreciate it very much.
Thank you for being such a nice guest.
So fun.
See you guys in the wrestling room.
All right.
See you, buddy.
Bye, Stephen. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Bye, buddy.
So are we really leaving? Or
we're really leaving. Yeah, yeah. No,
we're really leaving. We're really. Okay, I just know what this one of those things where, like, you go,
You broke me. You broke me with the Conan story. You fucking broke me in half. I never recovered.
True story.
I never recovered. I never recovered.
So we cannot use that, is what you're saying.
How about this? If he ever talks about it, if he ever said anything about me dropping a deuce when we were skiing, if he ever says anything like that, then all bets are off, obviously. Right. But I don't know anything about that.
Because that never happened, according to you. The other one never happened either.
What did he say anything about me? Because I know nothing about this.
Listen, no, I can't. We're not allowed to say anything about anything. Yeah. We're with an NDA with you. We're going to NDA with him.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're saying he said something.
I
mean,
I can't say that he said anything. I don't even know. I'm not even allowed to acknowledge the fact that he can talk.
Okay, good. Good. And whatever you do, do not broadcast the fact that up close, Conan looks like one of those guys they fish out of a bog in Ireland. Like, who was sacrificed in some Celtic ceremony like 3,000 years ago. And like you see him in a museum in Dublin, and they look like a catcher's mitt up in Cooperstown that was used by like Shoeless Joe Jackson, but they forgot to oil for 100 years.
You don't want us to say that. You don't want us to have you on record saying that.
That is super important. Of course, that not happen.
Of course, and we'll respect that. We'll respect that.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Because he still can bust a move in this town, and I don't want to make any enemies.
Of course. Sure, you're safe with us.
We understand that.
All right. Goodbye. This is for real.
Goodbye, Stephen. Thank you. Goodbye.
Wow, Sean.
That guy should host a talk show. And let me tell you something. He knows how to get a conversation going, knows how to keep it going.
Keep it going. Okay, so that was crazy to hear Colbert tell a story that feels like we heard a different side of.
Yeah, Conan has a completely different...
And the question is now, who's the liar, you know?
Right.
And I mean, I guess this is where it comes into what camp are you in? Are you in Colbert's camp now?
Right.
Or are you in Conan's camp?
I'm going to say, at first, I believed Conan, but... You know, now that Stephen was just on, and maybe because he was just on, he was extremely persuasive in his
specific, and he was very specific, right, on the story. Yeah, he seemed a lot more specific than Conan.
He actually said, implied or even said that the excrement was safety cone orange.
Yeah,
right.
Obviously, again, as Colbert pointed out, in show business, you have to pick a side, and you can never deviate from it. Mm-hmm. But I would say that knowing Conan, you know, historically, I've known Conan for whatever, 20 years. He's such a fucking liar. So it's hard not to just immediately assume that because he is such a untruthful fucking person through and through.
I mean, when you run into him, he opens with a lie.
I don't know. Do you trust the fucking liar or do you trust the guy with the, I guess I'm going to go Colbert.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm Team Colbert. Let's just do that. Let's just land there for now.
Yeah, for
sure. All right.
Yeah.
Great guest.
He is, though. I mean, to be able to sustain the energy to do a daily talk show where you have to be, you know, interested every single day and write all of that stuff. And it's just...
I know, he's such a unique talent. I don't really know him. I know him from through the biz-dustry, through like award shows and stuff. We'd always end up getting kind of corralled into the same area for a number of years.
Such a quick wit.
I think that's background holding. As it probably
that's what they call it. Yes, yes. Because that's what the BH was for.
Yep.
And then they would, but we, and he was always, he and his wife were always so delightful and sweet and funny and cool and normal.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as a performer, he's just hilarious.
So funny.
Yeah. Here's the other thing. Conan is such a liar Yeah. That last year he tried to convince me, honestly, he, with a straight face, he tried to convince me that he grew up in Mumbai.
Mumbai!
Bye.
Smart.
Smartless is published and distributed with Simplecast.